Accession number 34702.
Real 7.
Eric Dana, Real 7. So you went to Derby then?
I went to Derby. The Octu was at Derby, yes.
So what did that involve? Because obviously you've got a lot of experience, RAF experience now, haven't you?
At
that stage.
Yes.
And a lot of flying hours. So how do they approach somebody with your experience for the training?
For starters, you took down all your rank. So you were all cadets, officer cadets. It was a mixture of air crew going for commissions, some ground crew, warrant officer ground crew, engineers, people like that. Straight entrance. People like medical officers, padres, people like that, who did a sort of truncated course. And others that were going through, other than that, went through Cranwell, of course. So it was a mixture of people, a mixture of ages, which was another thing, because this was very physical, this particular course. On the lecturing side, it was all on the Air Force law and that sort of thing.
Were you fairly au fait with that side of things after that amount of experience you'd had with the RAF?
Not really, no, because as an NCO, you didn't get involved in courts of inquiry and all that sort of thing. So you didn't have the experience of taking people on charges and all, etc., etc., which was all going to come in theoretically anyway. So there was a lot of physical activity, a lot of RAF regiment stuff as well, so exercises and that sort of thing, cross country running, miles of that, drill, of course, the usual, there's always drill, and finally have interviews at various times with the flight commander and see how you're getting on and if you weren't coping in any particular sort of area. Some of the old hands, particularly the ground crew, warrant officers, couldn't take it. It was alien to them to be treated as airmen again, as it were, cadets. And one or two packed in the course. By and large, the air crew coped with it very well, even though they were sort of being humiliated, if you like, in some ways. At the end of the course, we did this camp thing, and the Point of Air, which is the northern part of the Isle of Man, where we went under canvas, and we had to do all our own cooking and all that sort of thing.
So was that living in the field, essentially?
Yes. Yeah, in tents, yes. That was the final sort of part of the course, by which time most people were inured to it anyway, so they coped all right. And we all thought it might be cancelled, actually, because there was they had snow on the Isle of Man. They hadn't had any snow for years. And in fact, on the passing out parade, we had to go out and shovel the snow off the parade ground before we could parade. My wife was there, and my parents were there as well. They'd come over for the passing out parade.
So how long had the course been, and when was it?
Derby, yes, let me see. If I can find out. Not in the main part of the logbook, of course. It's it was 1954, and it was over Christmas. That's right, Christmas came into it, and so it was early 1955, yes, when we passed out.
And how long was the course roughly?
Let me see. Several weeks. I don't know. I've got. No, I haven't got it in there. Might be in a later. Trouble's having all these logbooks put together. It's. I've rather lost the bits in the middle. No, I can't find it. Well, I left. No, it was several weeks anyway. I can't remember the exact time, but.
So it was into 1955 that where was your first posting then once you'd been commissioned?
I was posted from there to Driffield to do a meteor course, jet conversion in other words, prior to going on to the Canberra course.
Were you aware of, obviously, that was what you were going to be doing, or was it something that you only became aware of once you were commissioned, that was a sort of direction? Well,
they were always looking for QFIs, a lot of people, including myself, didn't want to do it, so it was compulsory to go to Little Risington and be interviewed to see whether it was suitable to do the QFI course. I think I made it quite clear I wasn't really interested, so that fell through. And then I had this meteor conversion at Driffield.
Tell me about that, Eric, then, how you go about converting to a jet aircraft. You know, the sort of differences, really, between jets and...
It's in the engine handling side, I suppose, and the different speeds, things like that. And in the case of the Meteor, which was particularly difficult on one engine, that sort of thing.
Why was it difficult on one engine?
Well, the engines were fairly well placed out in the wing, if you remember. And so that the torque effect on one engine was more pronounced than if the engines had been closer into the...
So is that a question of how you handle it once if you're only on one engine?
Yes.
Do you have to make adjustments? And...
Well, you have to use a lot of strength with your leg to maintain it straight and level, or even in manoeuvring, depending on how much power you've got to have on the other engine to keep you in the air, of course.
So with the Meteor, what's the sort of sequence of instruction that you go through on the conversion?
Well, you go through the same sort of thing as you do on most aircraft, familiarisation with the aircraft itself, bit of ground school, bit of teaching about the engines and the usual introduction on the flying side. Carrying out the usual sort of exercises.
And were these twin seats?
Yes, dual control Meteor 4.
So would they then take you through the whole sort of... Are you going almost straight back to the very beginning again? Because you mentioned, obviously, familiarisation and stuff. Do they take you back to your sort of earliest flying sort of...
No, I mean, they assume as you've been flying for a number of years, you know all about that. It's just a matter of assimilating to a jet engine and the different handling requirements. In fact, that there's a lag with jet engines, things like that, which you have to take into account.
Is that a lag when you want to accelerate or when you're taking off, something of that order?
Yeah, but if you're flying on one engine, you've got the other one throttled right back. Whereas with a piston engine, you push the throttle forward, you get an immediate reaction. It's somewhat delayed on because the revs have got to build up to inside the compressor. So it would be circuits and asymmetric checks and all the rest of it, and then going solo, of course, on type. High speed runs I see here, bad weather circuits.
Oh, so that's purposely putting you into bad weather, isn't it, in the aircraft?
Instrument flying. Quite a lot of instrument flying under the hood. Was standard in the course, although I was not going on to a fighter aircraft. Aerobatics was part of the course, which you had to complete, which was not necessarily my best feature, but I wasn't too worried because I knew I wouldn't be doing any aerobatics in the Canberra.
With the aerobatics in a jet, are they easier to perform in a sense than maybe with a
well, I suppose you've got more power in some instances, but otherwise, no, pretty much the same. Although, with a multi-engine aircraft, it's slightly different, I suppose, keeping even power.
Was there more emphasis on that sort of all-weather flying?
Yes, we've got a lot of instrument flying here. And formation flying, of course, another part of it. And a bit of cross-country flying, navigation, A to B. And
was that performed in the same way? Because you mentioned when you trained initially on your cross-country flying, that a lot of it was done at a height where you could see the ground.
Yeah.
Was it different in the Meteor?
Not really, no, much the same. We're relying a lot on visual references.
And still map reading at
that
stage?
Yes, map reading, yes. Well, you didn't have a navigator or anything, you were on your own, so.
Is it a thing, though, with jet aircraft that sometimes you need to be thinking a little bit more ahead?
Well, because of the speed, yes.
Yeah.
Mm. Yes, I suppose so.
So is that just getting used to the difference?
Just getting used to the difference in speed from getting from one point to another, that's all really. It's from there then, August 1955, 231 OCU at Bassingbourne. For conversion onto the Canberra B2.
So take me through this, Eric, about the conversion onto the Canberra.
Well, it's back to the same sort of thing, really, you know, a bit of dual stuff and demonstrations, and then first solo, cross-country, circuits and all the rest of it, and then instrument flying.
So is that a conversion, is it again with this? Is this
an IRT, an instrument rating test.
Is this just to get you used to this particular type of aircraft?
Yes, yes.
Can you tell me about the Canberra then?
Well, this has become now the standard bomber command, although it was a light bomber compared with the Lincoln, which were heavy bombers, I suppose. A nice aeroplane to fly, yes. No problems. Well, there were later on, but because it had this all-movable tailplane, electric-operated, instead of flaps on the elevators, and the tailplane itself used to move. Now that did cause some crashes later on, and the cameras did get grounded occasionally for this. Otherwise, a nice enough aircraft to fly, yes.
I've heard
we carried two navigators.
Oh, how did that work then? Where was everybody positioned?
Well, one was a navigator and one was a bomb aimer.
And what was the sort of, cockpit setup for everybody? And where did everybody sit within the camera?
I'm just trying to remember now. I think there was only one seat at the front. I'm not sure, quite honestly. So long ago now.
So I'm assuming they would sit somewhere behind you then, would they?
No, there must have been two seats, yes, because instruction, yes. And the navigators would sit behind, yes.
So was it a crew of three normally? Would that be...?
Yes. Yes. It's a pilot and two navigators, yes.
I've heard it described as quite a stable aircraft for a jet aircraft.
Oh, yes, yes. Very stable, yes. And then we went on to do the night conversion, of course. And beam approach stuff and all the rest of it.
And are you, at that stage, do you sort of crew up with somebody?
Yes, we crew up then, yes. And we're posted as a crew then.
How was that achieved? Because I know obviously about wartime crewing up where people were just put in a room together. Is it not the case, obviously, by this stage? Were you just allocated...
I don't know, we just sort of drifted together, I think, while on the course, before the flying started with the ground school, and then you sort of sorted out between you.
Oh, so in a sense it is still the same sort of wartime career. Oh,
yes.
So you find who you think you can work
with.
Well.
Yes, yeah. And at the end of the course then, that was September 1955, I was posted to RAF Binbrook, ostensibly to join 617 Squadron, which was operating the Canberra B6. This was an improvement on the B2 with a longer range, extra tanks, fuel tanks. However, when I got to... Binbrook, I found the squadron wasn't there, it was away on detachment in Malaya, and rather than wait for them to come back, the CO said to me, well, there's a vacancy on 101 Squadron, you might as well go and fill that. So I joined 101 Squadron at Binbrook, flying the Canberra B6. The CO was a squadron leader, Bunny Moorcroft. He had a DSO, which was unusual, from the wartime. Very nice chap, a navigator. Unusual then for a navigator to be CO, became more common later on. And he flew with me a few times. The flying on the squadron was sort of bombing practice bombs, little 25 pounders and that sort of thing, instrument flying practice just to keep yourself up. You had to, of course, have an instrument rating test, which was graded either from white to green to master green, depending on experience and how you handle the test. You had to renew that every year.
So what did the test involve then?
Well, it involved all the aspects of flying, but on instruments. In other words, they were under a hood, including things like engine failure and what were known as unusual positions recovery, where the examiner would put the aircraft in to some unusual position, like a dive or a stall or something like that, and you'd be under the hood and you'd have to recover just using the instruments without any reference to the outside horizon.
It seems there was a lot more emphasis then on instrument ratings and stuff like that. Well, career has moved on.
That came in, yes. I think it was introduced in the 50s, the instrument rating system, because up to then there'd been no way of knowing how good anybody was under the hood or in actual cloud conditions, because they may not have survived it, I don't know.
Was it a lot to do as well with this idea of moving again to a kind of all-weather force?
Oh, yes. And of course, navigation equipment was getting better all the time, so whereas before, you would have had to try and pinpoint yourself visually by some means, even coming down below cloud, which was obviously very dangerous. Now you're beginning to get things, radar in the aircraft, H2S and things like that, which enable you to navigate in cloud or above cloud.
Can you tell me then, Eric, as well,
when you were
flying in the Canberra with the navigators, can you give me a sort of idea of the demarcation of everybody's role? You know, what you do as a pilot, what the navigator does for you, you know, and how you communicate what you're doing, if that makes sense.
Well, they communicate via the intercom, yes. The pilot would do all the flying of the aircraft, obviously. The navigator would get you to the target. Then the nav bomb aimer would do the actual release of the bombs, either visually or by any other means.
And are you, as pilot, you're in command of the aircraft, are you?
Pilot is captain of the aircraft, yes. In most cases. And St. Dawes apply in coastal command, but in most other areas it did, even if the pilot captain was an NCO and the navigator was an officer, and he was still captain of the aircraft. Unless somebody else was designated as such for any particular reason. As I say, in coastal command, it happened.
So the pilot would have responsibility for the aircraft
and the crew.
Yeah,
and passengers, if any.
And you would take, when you were flying somewhere, you would take information from the navigator as to the direction you should be flying?
He would keep a plot on a chart. It would have all been laid out beforehand, and then he would put all his notations and corrections and all the rest of it on there as he go along.
And would you have, as pilot though, would you have some idea of where you were supposed to be going?
I mean, as a pilot, I was supposed to have, as well as being a pilot, supposed to have a good knowledge of navigation, good knowledge of communications and equipment. And if you were in bomber command, presumably, also firing the guns from the turret if necessary.
So I'm assuming then if it's the case with when you're, say, piloting the Canberra and you're being told one direction to go, and you might be aware that it might be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be something that you would be pointing out?
You'd have to overrule then, yes, and use your power as captain, yes.
So most of the time in 101, was it a lot of bombing practice, was it?
Yes, and bomber command exercises.
What kind of heights would you do the bombing practice from? What was it, high level, or was it low level, or was it a combination of both?
We didn't do a lot of low level, generally fairly high level, although we did do some low level cross countries and things like that. And exercises, bomber command exercises, which one of the things is, if you've got a stream of bombers coming in, you have to have a fairly complicated system of getting them down or onto the ground. And you have to fly a certain pattern, a trombone as it's called, which could be lengthened or shortened, and so that you kept an interval between each aircraft and that sort of thing, and they were letting down at the same time, probably from about 30,000 feet or something like that, from the initial height. So there was practices like that, and
would you practice mass bombing then as well, in the sense of a formation dropping its bombs at once?
Oh, that, I'm just going to come on to that now, because from Binbrook, the squadrons there used to carry out a detachment to Malaya in rotation. It was stationed at Butterworth in the north, near Penang, and we were there to bomb terrorists, if you like, the terrorist camps, things like that. So we went out. Where were we? 1956, it would be, yes.